Maybe we should take up.
7, 8, 9, 10, 7, 8, 9, 10, 7, 8, 9. All right.
My partner has stated that he believed that the solution to the problem is to just give Negroes the right to compete on an equal basis in every area of life. I reject this position.
Oh, no, I don't mind you stating what my position is, but I don't want you to misstate it. I said that artificial means of bringing the Negro up to par are not satisfactory to me, because in its artificiality, the persons who acquire anything soon lose them to persons who have more experience than them.
Well, Nils, for instance, you're saying that when Myrdal said that we distributed a lot of land to Negroes and gave them some kind of advantage like this, that this would be a kind of a false equalization that they would soon lose. Is this what you're saying?
I'm not opposed to giving people preferred rights, but I'm saying that if you give them preferred rights alone, without the equal opportunity bit and without the even application of the law, then you're fooling yourself.
Well, if that's your position, I agree with it. What I'm saying is this, plain and simple, that you have, at this point, you have to give Negroes something more than an equal opportunity to compete. But whatever you give them, it must include an equal opportunity to compete. And if you're saying that, I agree. Because the other way, it's like...
I'm saying more than that. I'm saying that given a choice out of three, I would rather have the even application of the law.
Well, there's no question about it. I'm not denying that, but you taped it, and I believe me when I disagreed with you, that isn't what you said. I agree with what you said. Now you've just changed your position. I agree with you fully. Nothing to argue.
Well, of course, it seemed to me that when Nils went into this before, he seemed to be giving an individualized interpretation of the Negro's problem, and really that he's thinking in terms of what his situation is, and it would be easy for him to adjust.
No, I don't...
Wait a minute. Let me state what I'm...
One at a time, please.
Yeah. You, in essence, what you seem to be telling me is that it would be easy for you to adjust now if, let's say, all the doors were thrown open. And, you know, you could go in any store that you wanted to and have any job, that this is what you would want. But I think that the Negro needs more than that now. You see? To give you an example, in New York, as you know, they're having problems with the school problems. What the superintendent of schools in New York proposed to do, as I understand it, was to try to give, to bring the Negro schools up to par. But you've got a very great amount of opposition to this idea of trying to have some kind of artificial mixing of the schools. Busing the students in and out of districts so that you would have more or less racial equality and all, I mean, racial numbers equal or approximately equal in all the schools. Some Negroes, and the Negro leadership thinks that this is the answer because then you would have a kind of cultural intermixing. The administrative problems and such a thing are tremendous. But it seems to me that this kind of thing is a real problem. Merely to bring, to open up the doors to Negroes now will not solve their problem. You've got to have some kind of plan whereby the Negro is given opportunity to bring himself up to the standards. I mean, when I say the Negro on a nationwide basis.
But you know, Bob, this question of this cultural intermingling, this is a great thing. But I was discussing this with Marvin Kopakin last weekend. And I said to him that I'm not at all certain that I would want to send my kid to school in Harlem. And I think it's unrealistic to believe that you're going to get any segment of people to... Harlem has to admit that they have the worst schools, the worst ever damn thing. And these people are going to send their kids to Harlem? Marvin Kropotkin said, well, he had been concerned because he didn't know a single middle-class Negro who would be willing to send it. He thought he'd get more resistance from Negroes because most of the middle-class Negroes around New York send their kids to private schools.
So they do.
You see, so this is, you know, this is, I don't know exactly what we're going to make of it, but I do not believe. I think we're going to have to get a genius from someplace to give us a solution. But busing them in isn't the solution, believe me. Because I think we can all agree, there are schools I wouldn't want to send my kid to.
May I interrupt a second? On the busing them in technique, I've heard criticized this way. I know white people in New York and around New York who will say, I will welcome the presence of any Negro child in my school where my child is. I would fight to the death to have my child stay in the school where he is.
They would not want to send their children out of the school. They say, well, look, you can bring some in it. In other words, what they're saying in essence is, we don't have any, it seems to me, that we don't have any objection to your bringing in some children whose standards perhaps are lower than ours, who are at underprivileged schools, and bringing them in here. But we don't want to go to their schools or to send our kids to their schools where their standards might be lower.
That's right. They say, we'll hold these standards here and introduce any number of Negro students here. One thing is, my mother, I heard say, if it means taking a child of 8 or 9, and putting that child 2 hours on the bus. That's a cut two ways, of course. But this child, this is the wrong way to handle it. 2 hours out of a child of 8's life is impossible. Or even 1 hour extra hauling.
It has to be just an elimination of race, of school districts and boundaries. You see, this is going to be it ultimately in a community like New York. But I'd be damned if I can see, if I live in New York presently, and they want to bus my kid to Harlem. I just got Brooklyn, you know, Bedford-Stuyvesant section. I couldn't see that.
I think the leadership may be somewhat, the Negro leadership, may be somewhat impractical in the solution that they propose. But I think the main idea behind it, my interpretation, is to get the school board to doing something. At least the school board is thinking seriously about this thing, and they're thinking about now of trying to get the best teachers and to put more money into these schools. You see, that's been the situation. The best teachers in New York just don't want to teach in Harlem. And they don't teach in Harlem. The standards are lower at those schools, and as I understand it, the physical plant isn't the equal of the other schools. The standards are lower. The principals let the teachers get away with more. All from top to bottom, it's a bad system. And the people, the administrators of the public school system in New York just haven't been willing to do anything about it. And I think the same thing exists. I mean, you could take any place, either north or south. You've got the same situation as far as the Negro schools and the white schools. It's the same problem, just on a grand scale in New York.
There's a problem that's even, it's a problem that's going to be even more acute. For instance, in Washington, when you have something like 80% of all the children in the public schools are Negro, who's going to be bused in? Where are you going to get them? Bring them from West Virginia every morning, you see, that kind of argument. And New York is moving in that direction.
That's correct. I was reading in a paper today, I think that something like 60%, it's more than half of the school children in Harlem today are Negroes.
In New York City. Yes. And something like 80%.
Maybe it's Manhattan. It may not be the... I don't think it's the whole of New York City, just in the borough of Manhattan, anyway, I'm sure about
it. In the high school, yes, it's some terrific percentage. It's around 70%, I think, I read not long ago.
Well, of course, the problem is the leaders say this, that nothing is really being done to solve the problem as far as residents is concerned. So rather than, they started attacking the problem on the basis that if we can lift the education of these people to come out of the ghettos, perhaps then we can do something about the standards of society generally. But what, you know, what can you do? You can't shuffle people like a deck of cards as far as housing is concerned.
Well, you know, I'd like to get back to something that Mills said earlier, and sometime I do agree with Mills. When he wrote this article, and he pointed out that in New Orleans, one of the reasons why we had not, in effect, been able to elect anyone was because of this geographical dispersal of people. And this is true. I mean, Negroes in Harlem can elect a state representative. They can send Adam Clayton Powell to Congress. We can't do that here because of there are pockets of Negroes all over the city. But the fact that there are pockets of Negroes in the South may mean that it's going to be a hell of a lot easier to integrate the schools in the South than in the North. And this is why, when people make the comment that integration is going to come to the South, true integration and equality, before it hits the North, I think this is what they might have in mind.
Did I tell you the other day about this young lady who's a second in a class, a senior class, Howard University Law School, and her remarks to me, having lunch together in November? Her first words were, in conversation, she said, "I'm from the South. I was born and raised on a farm in Virginia. I have much more hope for the peace soon and an acceptable peace than I have in the North." She said, "One reason, we share a common history. We have lived on the same land. There's some basis for human recognition here. There's some human contact here we can fall back on." So even with the policeman in Birmingham using his revolver. So there's something in the bank to use, to draw on. He said, "I can't see it in New York. I can't see it in Detroit or Chicago."
That's maybe right. Of course, you know, the problem is, what is New York going to do with Harlem? What is Chicago going to do with the South Side? What is Los Angeles going to do with the town of Watts? Here are your problems. Believe me, the problem of the Negro in the North isn't altogether different from the problem that the Southerners had with slaves. They didn't know what the hell to do with them. And this is it. And the solution, I don't know. In the South, when these kids, I know when the boys that I went to school with are elected to public office, and they're being elected now, there'll be really radical changes when enough of them are elected. But in the North, it's a different kind of thing altogether. Given the kind of political equality that exists, and when I say political equality, I mean nothing more than the right to vote. I don't mean to imply that Negroes have political equality in the North or political power. But what I'm suggesting is, given the right to vote, given the kind of thing that Mills is describing, I wouldn't want to live anywhere but the South. The kind of thing that he talks about. Just something that doesn't really exist anyplace.
Let me shift the ground of the conversation a little bit, please. I know a Negro psychiatrist in Connecticut with whom I had one conversation, with whom I'll have others. He says that the new Negro movement, as he states it, is an assertion of the male principle. Take as for the male, the masculine principle, as opposed to the matriarchal society of the American Negro until all this generation. He reads it that way in the light of his profession. What kind of sense does that make?
Well, my immediate impulse is to agree with him purely from a masculine viewpoint, but certainly there have been Negro women who have made substantial contributions to the civil rights movement, and I can think of one immediately, Aretha Castle, and her sister and her mother, who have played a large part in the civil rights struggle here in New Orleans. I don't know If he's talking about matriarchal in the sense that, in the historical sense, as against patriarchal now, I would have to agree that the men are...
Do you mind not covering your mouth, please?
I would agree that now the male is assuming his, what I would consider his proper position in the role of things here in the South. This is not to say that women don't play a substantial part, because...
He wouldn't deny that, of course.
Yeah. Generally, I'd have to agree with him.
I don't know whether I agree or disagree with him. It's the kind of thing that has never occurred to me.
Well, I happen to know, because I read a great deal on this, that the so-called Negro society or Negro group generally has been characterized among certain psychiatrists and perhaps sociologists or even anthropologists as a matriarchal society, because of the fact that during going all the way back from slavery times, the mother of the family rather than the father has been the mainstay as a race. Of course, that this has persisted even down to present times. And of course, the existence of a great number of, for instance, common law marriages, or no marriages at all, where a woman might have, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 children. This kind of thing, I think, is the reason behind saying historically you've had this matriarchal society, which is now becoming patriarchal in nature. I would certainly agree that the male is, the Negro male is coming to the forefront in this movement. However, I don't feel that we have moved far enough away from the matriarchal societies yet. If we had a truly patriarchal society among Negroes, a patriarchal group, I would say we would probably have armed revolt in the United States today among Negroes. It's been unfortunate, perhaps, that the Negro male has been willing to take as much as he has and to have had his women and his children subjected to what they've been subjected throughout the years. Of course, this is one reason, perhaps, why the group has been characterized as more or less a matriarchal group, because of perhaps the lack of aggressiveness in terms of resistance to the system of segregation and discrimination that has existed in the South.
Are any of you acquainted with a book by Stanley Elkins? It's not widely known, but I think an important book, a book called simply Slavery, published by Chicago, University of Chicago Press. The thesis is primarily this, that only in the United States was the slave system directed at destroying the sense of identity and the sense of masculinity of the slave. That this was not true in Brazil or the West Indies or anywhere else it existed, because there marriage, in the Catholic countries, marriage was a sacrament recognized by the state, by the church, and by the slaveholder, whether he liked it or not. The priest came, there was a true marriage. And also the state in Brazil or in Cuba, despite all the abuses, had a supervisor outside of the owner who made visits and reports. So at least theoretically there was a place of appeal. An outside power placed against the owner's power, though often it didn't work. In theory, it was there. So you had a long history of revolt in Brazil and other places, with a very spotty history, a very limited history of revolt in America. And you had a deliberate, or at least instinctive, system of destroying our personality, particularly the male personality.
Do I understand you to say that?
This is his theory.
His theory is that there was no deliberate attempt to...
No, his theory is that only in America, you see, that's where the system was, in a way, paternalistic, as opposed to the more formal system on the Catholic countries. Did you just worked out, and either instinctively or deliberately, as a way of actually robbing the Negro man of his role, of his self-respect.
Well,
in a way that was not true in the South American countries or in Cuba and Haiti and those places. And the history of slave revolt, he says, indicates this.
Well, I like to challenge the use of the word paternalistic with reference to the system of segregation, because...
Well, I don't mean segregation, I mean slavery. Not segregation.
Well, with the system of slavery.
Well, the word's in quotes, and we can say, you know...
Mm-hmm. Well, in essence, isn't the system of segregation which has existed merely an extension of slavery and just in a different form? I mean, certainly it's the child of slavery. And in essence, it's just another kind of slavery. Just a more relaxed form of slavery. That's all segregation is.
I would
is.
Think that segregation is more invidious than slavery, because it robs a man of the only thing that he came here with, and that's the feeling that he can stand four square and meet whatever it is to challenge him.
In essence, you're agreeing with this man's thesis. And I've heard it on many occasions, and I've read it in different places. I can't quote anyone from whom I read it, but I'll tell you this. Are you familiar with Daniel Thompson's book called The Negro Leadership Class?
The one on New Orleans?
Right.
I read that.
In this book, I didn't read the whole book, but in this book, Thompson discusses this question, and he discusses the question of the concept of the matriarchal Negro society.
No one has, I haven't heard anything as yet that tended to relate the idea of a matriarchal family life among Negroes and how this is related to the Negro revolt.
Well, it's the Negro revolt is a revolt against the matriarchal family. In other words, where the Negro male is now beginning to realize that he has been robbed, in essence, of the role that he played. And that I mean, of course, this is an attempt, in a sense, to summarize what's happening among a group of some 20 million people in the United States.
That's the only problem I have with that,
Bob.
Which
is, in essence, a generalization. Huh?
The problem that I have with that is what Neil's touched on, and it's that you have a very significant part of this movement is being led and directed by women. And I don't think that this accounts for it. You see. And this is my problem. I mean,
of course, the women play a greater portion than meets the eye. For example, I imagine if my wife strenuously opposed some of the activities that I follow as a result of my work in civil rights, that it would restrain my activities substantially. And this is a substantial contribution, as I see it.
But here again, you're attempting to interpret what we see as a movement in terms of this particular one example involving yourself.
Well, Bob, whether you admit it or not, all interpretation is based largely upon your own personal experiences and your ability to project and imagine what goes on.
But it wouldn't be based upon just your own personal
experience.
The one example of the effect that it has on you, at least you would try to,
well, it's not difficult.
To bring out of your experience what you have learned from a number of different examples and then summarize it. Not just based on what you yourself felt or what someone told you. Actually, you may feel a little different about it. I would, you know, if you were trying to say what you think is happening here, you might disagree with what's happening, but you may interpret it as this as being what is going on because I see so many examples of it. And to me, of course, I don't think that we're basically disagreeing, although Lois doesn't seem to get the same interpretation out of situation as you or I get. That is, that this in essence is becoming a revolt against the old, let's say, woman-led kind of family or society among Negroes generally.
What about Negro anti-Semitism? Does that appear in this community?
Mr. Warren, we've been so busy trying to get ourselves included into the mainstream of things that this is a luxury, really, that these, not, well, maybe it's a poor choice of words, but it's the kind of thing that occurs when you have, Well, the short answer is there is no anti-Semitism as far as I've been able to see.
I'd like to attempt to answer that, and really I want to attempt to answer it because I've been meeting with a group of Jewish women and one Jewish man, at least, in the past few weeks. Matter of fact, I'm going to speak to a pretty large group of them on the 19th. And they asked that very question. And I said my answer was exactly as Nils's answer. And I was reminded that a Baptist minister at a public meeting once, he was making a speech. We had just been denied the use of the municipal auditorium for the Reverend Martin Luther King. Two of the judges that overruled the district court were of the Jewish faith, or had been. It's highly questionable. Again, you know, is a person a Jew when he stops going to the synagogue? And this Baptist minister made the statement. He said, they denied us the use of this public facility. And two of them were Jews.
Who did this, you mean?
Who made the statement. Two of the judges.
It was a three-judge court.
And two of the judges were Jews. Mm-hmm. So the guy who is the who works for the Anti-Defamation League, he thought that, that this meant that there was, because this man is a noted Negro leader, that this this signified that there was a large amount of anti-Semitism in New Orleans. And this is what he said after I said I thought there was none. And I thought that he just misinterpreted what the man was saying altogether. I think that we feel very close to Jews, certainly I do. And the reason is because these people, those among them that see anything at all, they see, number one, that the Negro is nothing more than a buffer for Jewish people. I mean, if the white, this guy Guttridge, who said he had to have something between him and the ground, if he didn't have the Negroes, he'd have the Jews. No question about it. Number two, these people, I mean, particularly the learned Jewish people, I'm not talking about the Jewish people who don't want to be Jews, but who get mingled and, you know, get invited to a country club once a year on Brotherhood Week or something. Not those people, or those who change the names. But I mean the Orthodox and the conservative Jewish people. They identify themselves very closely with the movement, you see. And I would say that one other point, and it's that for the most part, Negroes don't make distinctions between white people. And this was true with me after I was 21 years old. I mean, either a person was white or colored.
All Chinese look alike, in other words.
I mean, this is right. No. You know, especially in terms of race. The only way I know that some people today are Jewish is because some guy who was Italian told me, he said, man, that we were discussing another lawyer in the case and say, well, that Jewish bastard, you can't trust him. And of course, I know what he tells this Jewish bastard when he talks about me, you know. I don't think there's any anti-Semitism in New Orleans still mounted.
There is in some places, of course.
There'd probably be some in New York.
Philadelphia had a bad case of it, apparently. I just read the papers,
I think it's stupid. I think it's just stupid.
Of course, I don't identify with the Jewish, with certain segments of the Jewish community that Lola's, I don't have the same identification that Lola's feels. At least I don't think I have the same identification. And the distinction with me now is white and black. Either you're white or you're black. And this is unfortunate, in my opinion, because this shows that the controlling factor, of course, is first color and then individuals, when it should be individual first.
Did you see the article in the morning item on the telephone recordings attacking Jews because they promoted integration? The reply to it, this long article, long news story.
The morning paper?
Morning paper, yes. Item, I guess it was that. That's what it's big. It's a big thing, two or three columns inside. This is Negro anti-Semitism. This is anti-Semitism because of a relation between the Jews and the Negroes.
Well, the Jews are certainly the chief financial backers of the civil rights movement, some for very selfish reasons. Most of the lawyers that have been willing to help us have been Jewish lawyers. Most of the white people have been willing to come forward and participate in demonstrations have been Jewish people. And this is one of the big reasons why the National Council of Churches and Catholic groups have decided to get active. So there's no question. I mean, you can start going down the line. Chief Counsel for CORE, Carl Rackland. Chief Counsel for Legal Defense and Education, Jack Greenberg. You can go down the list, and there are always, you look at CORE, there are many people when you say they are Jewish people. Now again, these are not always people who go to the synagogue. Some of them may even be Baptists, you see. So are they Jewish? In other words, if it's generic, you know, then I, you know, maybe Hebrew is the term we should use, you see. But I don't, I would hate to believe that Negroes would be anti-Semites, but on the other hand, I suppose some of them would have to be. This is a part of being American. You have to hate something, you know. If you don't, then you can't be an American.
May I come back to one of your essays?
I don't know if you properly call them essays.
Well, why not?
Notice that machine picks up the paper roughly.
So?
Pick it up,
Here's a quotation, or rather a summary. This is written a few years ago, by Doxy A. Wilkerson. The Negro has succeeded only in alliances with progressive economic or political trends, and not independent of such trends in the surrounding society. I'm going back to your little passage on the betrayals, you see, of Negro aspirations by the Declaration, not afterward, but in the actual writing of it, in the Constitution, in the time of the Civil War, you know that section you have.
Yeah.
The point here, to do the quote, this is the fundamental lesson of our history. And he saw the 1940s as another sharpening conflict in which the Negro's goal is bound with the general national goal.
Mm-hmm.
That the actual movements which have led to Negro advancement have been in terms of relation to a progressive white movement, not as a result of that merely, but an alliance that is formed with it. That each phase has been the special kind of alliance possible historically at that moment.
It might very well be that the civil rights movement is a complete example of this.
That's what I'm getting at. What would you say about that?
My position is that while certain impetus was given by the 54 Supreme Court decision, which of course was in the making for a number of years, that the entire causation was not solely within the factors which existed within the United States alone, but is a result more or less direct of the lack of decisive balance between perhaps the United States and Russia for leadership of the world. And as a result of this imbalance, it became necessary for the nation, for the United States, to corral as much influence from as many sources as it possibly could. Hence, the eventual 54 decision, which gave some more legal color to our claim for justice where none actually existed in fact previously, which would permit us to give some sort of credence to the story that we're trying to give the entire non-communist world. I don't know if I've articulated it sufficiently.
I'm following it. There are two questions then.
In other words, maybe from another standpoint, this is good for us because the closer the competition gets for the United States, and I said this 4 or 5 years ago, the closer the competition is between Russia and the United States, then eventually we'd have government officials and corporation officials coming to the college doors and sifting out the better brains of the Negro students. And this is apparently this is what is happening on a small.
Is there also, you think, a change in moral climate? I say this because your passage in your writing, which is not argued at length, of course, is summarized. I don't mean to attribute something to you that you don't hold. That's why I'm exploring it a little bit more now. Does not take into account a change in historical sense, in the historical sense, of moral climate.
No, I don't think there's been a moral change. I think this is
merely a question of the need, the practical need for...
I would think so, yeah.
That is, there's no moral improvement in the atmosphere of now as opposed to 1861.
I don't think so.
Don't think so.
Well,
how do you feel about that?
I would have to disagree with you, Nils. I think that we have a whole lot more people today, percentage-wise, in the United States who believe that segregation is immoral than believed it in 1861. If we don't, heaven help us. Because I think that not only do we have to gain legal victories and, let's say, get a civil rights bill passed, but we also want to change people's feelings with reference to the entire question of segregation and discrimination. We want them to feel that this is not only the thing that they must do because it's the law, but that it's the thing to do because it's right. And fortunately, now we have the church. Let's face the Catholic Church itself. Where was the Catholic Church in 1861? Where was the Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church?
Where is now?
All of these other churches that were supposed to give moral leadership to the country. I mean, they were silent. What's now? I think there's a different situation. Every time I get on the soapbox about religion, I get some snickers from these two guys. I think one is an agnostic and the other is an atheist, you see. When I get on the subject of morality, I mean, just too much for me.
You know, I've got to think about calling myself a cab. I've got an apartment 5 across town.
Want to stop it for a minute?
It's possible after the arrangements are made, suppose all the legal decisions are made favorable to civil rights, all the bars so far that can be barred be removed by legal action, then there is a question finally of a moral climate, isn't it? You have to aim at.
That's correct. Of course, as I think Martin Luther King once eloquently put it, it's not necessary for a man to love me in order to stop him from lynching me. I think that once the barriers are removed, that people's attitudes will change. And you had this question about whether you should wait for people's attitudes to change first before you institute these reforms.
That's a key question,
or,
isn't it?
You know, the question of whether law should come first, or whether the change of attitude of people should come first with reference to these things. This has certainly been a perennial question. But of course, I'm firmly of the opinion that the majority of the people in the United States want the change, and that we've had a very powerful and a very vocal minority in the South, which has constantly blocked legislation in Congress to stop some of the changes that should have been brought about a long time ago.
Because a very interesting point is that in the enabling provision of the 14th Amendment, Congress has had, since the enactment of the 14th Amendment, the power to pass legislation which would have affected the kind of thing that we're working for now. And this is a terrible indictment of the immorality. And whether it exists now or not, it seems to be something that doesn't even need to be discussed, because here you have the authority to do it, and public opinion in the minds of those people who should know, the politicians, wouldn't permit it. This is the only reason I can visualize why.
You mean then or now?
Then, yes. Public opinion may have changed now to the extent where we will get an enforceable civil rights bill.
There was no public opinion then to enforce it, though. Civil War period.
And it's questionable as to the kind of public opinion you have now.
There is.
In my opinion.
Well, when you say there was no public opinion then, you meant no public opinion in the South.
No, I mean in the North.
Even in the North.
It wasn't enforced. It died within about a few years, and it hit the big sellout of 1876.
Right.
And
Henry Grady.
And pardon?
And Henry Grady.
But before that, you get the
Tilden Hayes.
I recently read or reread C. Van Woodward's account of it. And I think I may have mentioned that somewhere in one of the bits on.
My point is, there was no public opinion of any consequence there in the period from 65 to 76 to enforce the policy subsequent to emancipation. There were little few things, like the Freedmen's Bureau, but this all disappeared very fast. It had very little effect, as we know. Is there more public opinion now to enforce legislation?
There's no possible question in my mind that there is. I don't know that people are any different now than they were then. But I think people's experiences with Negroes have been different. I think frankly, the desegregation of the armed services is possibly one of the most significant things that has happened in this country. I mean, the three of us did. We slept with guys, got up, and we ate together, and they were guys who admitted frankly and freely that they had certain misconceptions. That has since changed. You know, guys found themselves preferring a conversation with me than with the guy who was next to me, for no other reason than we were both reared in the city. Or maybe they liked the way I played poker. So I think that this, if nothing else, have created a certain kind of a climate. And then there's been an awful lot of talk about it. There've been Negroes who've been able to talk. There've been Negroes in the South. White people now no longer look to their maids to tell them what's going on. They buy Negro newspapers now. There were no books of any consequences. There were no James Baldwins or Richard Wrights or Ralph Ellisons that they could have read. And I'm thinking about this boy who wrote Go South to Sorry. It's now
Rowling, Carl Rowling.
Oh, Carl Rowling. These people didn't exist. And I mean, they have said something. And they've said something that people who were willing to think had thought about. And then we're living. There were no atom bombs. There were no newly emerged African nations. Even my own view have changed about the African people. I mean, what I learned about Africans was, man, I never knew one more Kenyatta existed. I mean, and all of these things. And people are asking themselves, well, what is possible in this world? I think the church is a little more vocal now than they were then. But they fall short of what they should be doing, or certainly what they could do, because the Catholic Church, the Methodist Church, and all of them still tolerate segregation within the church. There's no question in my mind about it. You're not going to have a Negro priest saying a mass at the Holy Name. You don't have any Negroes on the faculty at Loyola. So to my way of thinking, I know that there are some orders that exclude Negroes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Better
yell at him. You better let him yell, Nils, if you yell at Cabin and pull off.
Is that serious?
It certainly is serious. Negroes can't ride in the air.
I'll laugh
one
and yell.
Excuse me,
sorry.
Sorry.
Well, you
write down. That's it. You write down.
Sorry? Yeah. I once tried to ride in a Liberty Bell taxi cab. We were in front of the jungle.